And welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. There's still snow on the ground, but the days are marginally longer, so the trend line on at least one thing is moving in our direction. Today, we're looking at a place that is very important in the Middle East, but frankly, is largely ignored here at home, and that's Turkey. Our guide will be Aykan Erdemir of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Before we go to Aykan, your JPC commercial. We were established in 1985 as a 501c3 organization, providing analysis of both foreign and domestic policies. Our website is jewishpolicycenter.org, jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can read our insight articles. You can see our blogging context and our magazine, In Focus Quarterly. The winter 2022 issue of In Focus is out. Slightly delayed, I'll blame the supply chain, whether or not that's true. The topic in focus is China, what China does at home, what it does abroad, and how the U.S. has been responding to China. I will tell you up front, it's depressing, but I think it's important. And I think we have a great stable of authors to address the important parts of China and China policy. As most of you know, the JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defenses. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC supports small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. I think we're going to add election security to that very soon. In this series of calls, we've been pleased to bring you scholars and policymakers on issues from the Abraham Accords, to China and Turkey in Central Asia, to the disastrous American abandonment of Afghanistan, to U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and the American defense budget. We have, as I've said, considered Turkey before, specifically in terms of the Armenia-Azerbaijan war and Turkey's role in the Syrian civil war, among other things. Today, we're going to look at Turkey again as it navigates a truly terrible economy made worse by Turkey's own choices and a region that seems increasingly open and friendly to Israel, even as Turkey is going the other way. Our guest is Aykan Erdemir, director of the Turkey program at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He's also a former member of the Turkish parliament, and he served in the EU-Turkey Joint Parliamentary Committee, which I think today sounds like a little bit of an anachronism. An outstanding and outspoken defender of pluralism, minority rights, and religious freedom in the Middle East, Aykan has been at the forefront of the struggle against religious persecution, hate crimes, and hate speech in Turkey, which is why he's living in Washington. He is a founding member of the International Panel of Parliamentarians for Freedom of Religion or Belief, a drafter and a signatory to the Oslo Charter for Freedom of Religion and or Belief, as well as a signatory legislator to the London Declaration on Combating Antisemitism. In recognition of his work on behalf of those who often cannot defend themselves, Aykan was awarded the Stefanos Prize. The Stefanos Prize, and I admit that I didn't know what it was, and I had to go look this up, is very interesting. It is a human rights prize awarded to individuals for their outstanding contribution to defending freedom of religion or belief, as defined by Article 18 of the Universal Declaration for Human Rights. I think that's an amazing, amazing accomplishment. A Harvard PhD, Aykan has edited 7 books and co-authored one with the fascinating title, Antagonistic Tolerance, Competitive Sharing of Religious Sites and Spaces. His work has appeared widely in the American media, and he has been a contributor to our own In Focus magazine. Remember, questions are welcome. Use the Q&A function on your screen. Aykan Erdemir, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Shoshana, again, for this kind invitation. Thank you to the Jewish Policy Center for allowing me to address this distinguished audience once again. Let me begin by underlying one word in my title, that is risks. Now, each year, the Eurasia Group's president in Bremer comes up with a list of top 10 global lists. And this year, he again had an op-ed in the Time magazine, where he listed the top 10 risks and then presented his justification for that. And as you can expect, Turkey was one of the top 10 global risks for 2022, alongside COVID, Russia, China, and Iran. Now, it is odd to see a NATO member state among the top 10 global risks, especially at a time when you have analists in DC who would argue that Turkey is, even under Erdogan, an important counterweight to Russia and Iran, and hence should be a key US partner in the region. Now, if you go back to Bremer's justification for why Turkey is on the list, I would like to share with you the following three sentences he presented. He said, quote, "Unemployment and inflation are high, and the lira is weaker and more volatile, but Erdogan has rejected orthodox economic management." He then added, "His foreign policy will grow more combative this year to distract voters from the economic crisis." And he said, "In the unlikely event of early elections in 2022, all these risks will be exacerbated." So that doesn't look very bright for Turkey from Bremer's point of view. Now, let me present you with mine. Now, the boring part of the story is Turkey is yet another country, yet another society, yet another economy ruined by political Islam. And at that level, it doesn't require much explanation because it is simply the latest example of an consistent trend that we have witnessed elsewhere in the world. Whether at the state level or the non-state level, you know, political Islam is a sure path to impoverishment, war and famine, and all the ills that come with it. But what makes the Turkish story worth paying attention to is because I would argue that Turkey has been the most advanced, you know, most institutionalized, most the best functioning polity that political Islam has ruined, you know, over the last century. Hence, it requires a deep dive into it. And I will start with the economy, because as they say, it's the economy, stupid. Here, the key question is, you know, what is behind Turkey's financial meltdown? And what is this unorthodox economic policy that Bremer, just like, you know, Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal and The Economist, have constantly been referring to, especially over the last few years? Now, for that, I have to take you into Erdogan's brain and the peculiar way in which he sees the world. Erdogan believes, against all economic wisdom, that high interest rates lead to high inflation. So he argues to bring down Turkey's rampant inflation, he needs to cut interest rates, policy rates of the central bank. Now, as you're watching very closely in the US, the Federal Reserve has already signaled it will hike interests maybe three or four times in 2022, as the inflation has reached 7% as of, you know, December's end. But if the Federal Reserve were to listen to Erdogan, they should be cutting interest rates further. Now, Erdogan actually put his money where his mouth is. And in the last 4 months of 2021, he forced the central bank, which is no longer independent, to cut interest rates from 19% to 14%. And as you can imagine, the result was a skyrocketing of inflation. As of year end, Turkey's inflation is at 40%. And this is only after industrious efforts by Turkey's statistical institute, namely the Turkstat. And most independent observers would argue that the real CPI, you know, consumer price inflation, is roughly double that. So clearly, Erdogan has been proven wrong. Not that we needed that, but he hasn't gotten the message. You know, he would deny that he has been proven wrong. So he's doubling down on his economic, unorthodox economic policy. Now, you might wonder, why is he committing economic suicide? And for that, I have to take you to his ideological prejudices. You know, this is a politician who from his teenage days was socialized among Turkey's various Islamist movements and political parties. And since Turkey's Gezi Park protests of 2013, he has been making a reference repeatedly to a concept coined as the interest rate lobby. Now, this is a euphemism, an anti-Semitic euphemism, to refer to the global Jewish community. And in Erdogan's parlance, the interest rate lobby is a nefarious force forcing high interest rates on Turkey to take Turkey hostage. And to fight the interest rate lobby, he has to bring down the interest rates, no matter what the costs are. So there is also an irrational element to Erdogan's fight against interest rates. And in fact, I predicted this, you know, back in 2018, 2019, when we had the earlier signs of this irrational policy. I had a foreign policy piece where I warned Erdogan's anti-Semitism will sink Turkey's economy. And back then, not many people paid attention because they assumed, what could be the connection between anti-Semitism and, you know, a financial meltdown? Because one arguably belongs to a more soft domain of policy issues, and the other one is kind of more of a hard policy issue. But I think by 2021, we have all seen how the ideological, how the cultural can have a significant impact on the well-being and future of, you know, 85 million Turkish citizens. Now, to back up his policy, because as you can guess, when you lower policy rates, the Turkish lira also loses its value against the US dollar. And by the way, just to give you an idea about how horrible this is, over the last 3 years, the lira lost 60% of its value against the dollar. And when we talk about Turkey, which imports over 95% of its hydrocarbon and pays in US dollars, you can imagine the effect this has on the average wage earner in Turkey. And through the pass-through effect on inflation is also horrible. So Erdogan has fought another suicidal fight against the devaluation of the lira by selling hard-earned foreign currency of the central bank. And in 2019 and 2020 alone, Erdogan admitted to selling $165 billion of the Turkish central bank's foreign currency reserves. Now, this is economic suicide, literally. And as of the end of 2021, the central bank's net international reserves plunged to just $8.6 billion. So Turkey has nearly depleted its foreign currency reserves, if you believe Erdogan's numbers. But as I've been warning you, there is a lot of creative accounting going on. And Erdogan actually has been busy with a window dressing tactic. He has signed swap deals, you know, lira dollar swap deals with China, Qatar, and South Korea. And he also had Turkish lira dollar swap deals with local Turkish banks, which means a lot of the so-called currency reserves the central bank has actually only exist on paper because they are actually liabilities the Turkish Central Bank has in exchange for the lira it provided to China, Qatar, South Korea, and Turkish domestic banks. So Goldman Sachs did the math for us. So if you subtract all these, window dressing swap deals, Turkey's real foreign currency reserves stand at, and buckle up for the figure here, minus $66 billion. So Turkey's foreign currency reserves at this point are not only depleted, but they're in the negative. And this, of course, is reflected in the Turkish lira's ongoing meltdown because international observers, investors are not fooled by Erdogan's financial shenanigans. Now, what makes Turkey's risk even bigger is the fact that it is decoupling from other emerging market economies. They are acting with greater prudence, hiking policy rates, and try to increase their foreign currency reserves because they know the Federal Reserve will increase rates and this will put additional pressure on them. This will prevent their easy access to abundant liquidity, which characterized the global economy maybe until the end of the last year. And they know that 2022 will be a much more difficult, there will be a lot of headwinds for emerging markets. Now, Turkey, by decoupling itself from emerging markets, is literally signaling to global investors to exit the Turkish market. Already, we have seen some big investors exit Turkey last year. For example, Italy's UniCredit sold all of its shares at a loss in one of the major Turkish banks, Yapı Kredi, last year, because they simply didn't want to take what I call the Erdogan risk. Now, there are others, though, who are doubling down. For example, Spain's BBVA is in the process of buying all the remaining shares of Turkey's Garanti Bank because they believe that Turkey has hit rock bottom in 2021. And from now on, things can only get better. And in 2022, I think BBVA shareholders might have a hard lesson in how things can get worse as long as Erdogan remains at the helm. Now, this was just two international financial institutions that I mentioned, but let me give you the broader trend. There has been an ongoing Western exodus from Turkish equities and bonds, sovereign bonds, as well as corporate bonds. In 2018, 19, 20, and 21, we have recorded negative outflows. Just to give you the size, in 2013, when things looked much better, foreign holdings of Turkish equities were at $82 billion. After all these negative outflows, they are now coming close to $20 billion. So over $60 billion have left Turkish equities. Similarly, foreign investment in Turkish bonds, which used to be over $50 billion, is now below $10 billion. This exodus is so devastating that last year, MSCI, one of the world's largest index providers, global index providers, considered downgrading Turkey's status from an emerging market to a frontier market. Now, this is the ultimate relegation for an emerging market, especially for an emerging market like Turkey, to be considered to be on the same footing as frontier markets, which have extremely, troubled economies, and some of which would not deserve to be called a market economy. And just to give you the impact of such a potential move, that reclassification of Turkey would single-handedly trigger a $3 billion outflow from Turkish equities as some of the passive investment funds that automatically track this index would be forced to sell all their equities. So I would argue, as opposed to the BBVA analysts, that there is still room for the Turkish economy to get worse, and Turkey has still not hit rock bottom. And another figure I have is from JP Morgan's Global Diversified Bond Index. And just to show you how Turkey fell within this index, back in 2018, Turkish bonds constituted over 5% of this global index. Today, Turkish bonds account for less than 1.1%. So again, all these figures point to an ongoing financial meltdown in Turkey. Now, if we go to the second part of Bremer's risk assessment, which had to do with foreign policy. Now, as you can imagine, all these mismanagement and corruption story at home and the impoverishment of the average Turkish citizen creates rationale, creates pretexts for Erdogan to double down on his foreign policy adventurism. This would not only divert the electorate's attention away from the economic mismanagement and corruption at home, but it could also provide a rally around the flag effect in the run-up to Turkey's 2023 presidential and parliamentary elections. Moreover, Erdogan could prefer to go to elections in the midst of a war or during a state of emergency, which would give him an opportunity to crack down on the opposition. Not that he's not already doing that, but he could double down on his crackdown. Now, all of this is, of course, leading to another risk, and that is Turkey, a country of 85 million citizens and 3.6 million Syrian refugees, bordering two EU member states, Bulgaria and Greece, and also a maritime border to another EU member state, Cyprus, could turn out to be also not only a failed state hosting Syrian refugees, but also a failed state sending its very own refugees to the European Union. Now, if that turns out to be the case, if we start seeing massive migration flows from Turkey, and I'm distinguishing this massive outflows from what we are witnessing right now, which is a brain drain. So already there is an exodus of highly skilled workers from Turkey to the European Union, but there's not much complaint on the EU side. But if Turkey becomes another Syria and Turkish refugee flows compound, Syrian refugee flows, that also is another risk, not only on the European Union, but also on mainstream politics, because we know since the beginning of the Syrian civil war, massive refugee inflows to the European Union have eroded the support for center-right, center and center-left parties to the advantage of far-left and far-right parties. So contagion, the risk of contagion from Turkey is not just financial contagion for Western institutions and Western economies, but also it could have disruptive effects through refugee flows, and which would play a further destabilizing role and spoiler role within mainstream political scene in the European Union. Now, if I were to take a guess, I know no wise social scientists would be in the business of predictions, but what could be the top theaters to watch for Erdogan's adventurous foreign policy, for gunboat diplomacy, for cross-border operations, or for Erdogan's airlifting of Syrian Islamist mercenaries to be used in other you know, theaters of action. I would say Syria is, again, the top risk. There have been three cross-border operations, and Erdogan could choose to carry out a fourth cross-border operation, not against the Assad regime, but against Syrian Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, Washington's key allies in the fight against the Islamic State. And the reason why a fourth cross-border operation is risky is because the earlier cross-border operations have actually pushed U.S. forces and their Syrian allies out of the territories they controlled. And guess who filled that vacuum as of now? Russian troops, Iranian proxy forces, as well as Assad's regular forces and militia. So Erdogan could once again play a spoiler role in Syria, which Russia, Iran, and the Assad regime will be happily waiting to take advantage of. Northern Iraq, Iraqi Kurdistan, could be another theater of action. Turkey already has significant military presence there. And if there is an expanded military operation into Iraqi Kurdistan, this would also undermine both the legitimacy and some of the internal workings of the Iraqi Kurdistan. And again, you can guess that Iran would be delighted to see that, given the Iranian hegemony, not only in Baghdad, but also in Iraqi Kurdistan, appear to be deepening. Now, Izmir is a popular zone for Erdogan. He has used gunboat diplomacy over the years to play a spoiler role to prevent the Izmir Gas Forum from going forward with its win-win cooperation, you know, among littoral states, including Greece, Cyprus, Israel, Jordan, Egypt, to build the hydrocarbon resources in the region and to build a pipeline to the European Union, which would be a win-win solution because it would also help lessen the West's dependence on Russian hydrocarbons. But I know that as of early 2022, and we can go into this in the Q&A, that even the U.S. appears to be, you know, walking away from an EastMed hydrocarbon cooperation. And Erdogan appears to be one of the pressures on this project. You know, he has been advocating for these maximalist and irredentist maritime claims and trying to, basically he's literally scaring away energy firms from investing in the region, and also increasing insurance premiums, you know, making projects less feasible by adding to political risk, macro risk for such projects. Now, Libya is one arena where Erdogan and his Syrian proxies have been present. So that's a good theater to watch for. And Erdogan did send Turkish forces, you know, drones, as well as Syrian mercenaries to Nagorno-Karabakh in the South Caucasus. And that could also be another theater of action where things could flare up. Although for the time being, there appears to be at least some process in place for Turkish-Armenian rapprochement, and that could keep the risks under control for now. Now, in an attempt to try to end on a positive note, let's turn to the potential opportunities, because most risks come with also some opportunities. Now, first, let's begin with Erdogan himself. Turkey's economic meltdown and Erdogan's increasing isolation in the East Med as well as in the Middle East have forced him for some course correction in 2021, at least a different, rhetoric coming from Ankara, and this might continue in 2022. Last year, we have seen Erdogan reach out to Israel, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia, you know, four countries that he has been engaged in a very hostile relationship over the years. Now, I'll just go over very briefly on these issues, but when it comes to Israel, Erdogan joined Iran and Hamas to condemn the Abraham Accords. At this point, he appears to be eager to, you know, reestablish full diplomatic relations and exchange ambassadors with Israel. Whether he will walk the talk, we'll yet see, because, you know, Erdogan often fails to deliver. With Egypt, again, Erdogan would once again like to access the Egyptian market. You know, Turkish investors and exporters have been pushed out. Erdogan has reached out to Cairo, but the Muslim Brotherhood continues to use Istanbul as its, you know, number one headquarters worldwide. And as long as that state of affairs continues, I don't think Egypt would be too eager for such a rapprochement. And the same with Israel. As long as Hamas continues to find such a convenient logistical and support base in Istanbul, I don't think Israel would be too keen to jump, you know, all in for such a rapprochement deal. When it comes to the UAE, you know, in the Turkish pro-government media, the UAE was always presented as the arch enemy. They were accused to be behind the coup, and Turkey was involved in proxy wars against the UAE in Libya and elsewhere. But right now, at least on the economic domain, things appear to be improving. You know, the UAE has already mentioned potentially investing up to $10 billion in Turkey's companies. And they argue that Turkey's economic crisis and devaluation has severely undervalued its assets. So this is a good time to snatch those assets. But we'll wait and see. And when it comes to the Saudi Arabia, there is a lot of bad blood between MBS and Erdogan. And let's see in 2022, when Erdogan is scheduled to pay a visit to Saudi Arabia, whether some of those ties could be repaired. Now, this is on the Erdogan front, you know, so these are opportunities which might not materialize. But then there are other opportunities that are outside Erdogan. And that is, we have seen with the economic meltdown an unprecedented exodus from Erdogan's support base. So in the polls, his popularity has hit rock bottom in the last 20 years. And his Islamist-rooted Justice and Development Party, as well as his coalition partners in the ultra-nationalist Nationalist Action Party, have been bleeding voters. Now, this could be a path for democratic transition in Turkey. That is, with the 2023 presidential and parliamentary elections, Turkey's opposition bloc, united opposition bloc, just like in 2019, when they won most of the municipalities in Turkey, could win both the parliament and the presidential office in Turkey. And this could be a significant turning point in history, in Turkish history, because such a victory could also hit all birds with one stone, because they would not only defeat Erdogan, but also his closest allies, the far-right ultra-nationalists, the pro-Russia, pro-China, pro-Iran Eurasianists in alliance with Erdogan, as well as, you know, the idea of hyper-centralism and one-man rule and anti-Westernism that have characterized Erdogan's rule. So that would be the best case scenario. That is, if the opposition gets its act together, as it did in 2019, and if Erdogan is willing to play relatively fairly and concede defeat, then Turkey could once again not only restore democracy and the rule of law, but also reorient its foreign and security policy to its traditional policy of, you know, cordial relations with the transatlantic alliance and its partners. Now, I can hear you thinking out loud that would Erdogan allow for such a defeat? Would Erdogan literally walk himself out and put himself in front of a potentially and in front of a Turkish court? Not only himself, but his inner circle of family members and business cronies. And that brings me to my worst case scenario, because ultimately, if Erdogan is not willing to go down without a fight, he could turn Turkey's competitive authoritarian regime, which is defined by a slim chance that the opposition could win the unlevel elections in Turkey, to a full-fledged authoritarianism where there is no more any path to a democratic ousting of the Erdogan regime. Now, this would be the end of Turkey's 75 years of multi-party experience with relatively free and relatively fair elections, as well as, in a way, the end of Turkey's 150 years of experimenting with parliaments of different sorts. And the outcome would then be a further hollowing out of Turkey's institutions, a greater institutionalization of political Islam in Turkey, and possibly the worst effect could be a strengthening of defeatism in Washington and Brussels, as European and American allies of Turkey stop seeing Turkey as a NATO member that could one day be salvaged, and instead see it as Erdogan's Turkey, and then turn to appeasement, you know, giving up any hope of reform in Turkey. They could simply switch to a full force appeasement mode, which, in my opinion, have brought Turkey to, you know, where it is today. So to end with a policy suggestion, given I'm speaking at the Jewish Policy Center, I would argue that what the United States and the European Union do today will matter much more than what they will do or threaten to do after Turkey's elections. So there is a narrow window of opportunity until the summer of 2023, roughly a year and a half, in which there should be very clear signaling to the Erdogan regime that there will be a concerted transatlantic pushback if and when he attempts to steal the elections, and if and when he refuses to concede defeat. And the pushback should be targeted and very personal. You know, this should be a set of targeted sanctions aimed at, you know, Erdogan's wealth in, you know, offshore havens abroad, targeting Erdogan's inner circle of family members and cronies, and never underestimate the leverage the West has, given almost all of the world's kleptocrats depend on Western financial institutions to keep their pillaged wealth, to purchase property, and to take refuge when things get rough. So if the transatlantic alliance signals to Erdogan that there will be costs, like literal material costs, if he tries to, pull some cards up his sleeve in the run up to and in the immediate aftermath of the elections, I would argue that this would increase the chances of a freer and fairer election, as well as Erdogan's conceding of defeat. Hence, this is really the time to act. And although I have been making this call in multiple, on multiple platforms, am I hopeful? Not really, because neither the Biden administration nor the European Union appear to be paying much attention to the risks and opportunities Turkey presents, given the mess in Afghanistan, I think it would be naive to assume that my call for a concerted and effective transatlantic action would become reality. But nevertheless, we should continue to act with the pessimism of the mind and the optimism of the will. And let me end on that note.
Thank you. I thought I was depressed before we started this program. Okay, but we do have some questions. First, just a kind of technical question. Somebody asked if you could give us an example of a frontier economy. What country can we look to?
For example, if you take a look at Central Asia and all the stans, you know, Kazakhstan, you know, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, those would be frontier markets. And what really characterizes them is, you know, the near absence of, you know, the rule of law and due process, the, let's say, markets, you know, stock markets and bond markets not being very mature, you know, the corporate scene, you know, not being developed. And so from that perspective, Turkey is definitely not a frontier market. Right. But it took Erdogan's 20-year effort to bring Turkey to that level.
Great. That makes it much more understandable. So back to the points that you were making, you don't foresee, at least for the moment, any transatlantic or NATO-oriented push on Turkey, perhaps for the next election in a year and a half, but not now. Does that leave a space for the emerging group of Egypt, Greece, Cyprus, Jordan to create its own pushback on Turkey? Egypt is angry about the Muslim Brotherhood headquarters. Israel is angry about a lot of things. Cyprus is angry about a lot of things. And you mentioned that Erdogan wants them and he's courting them in various ways. Is there potential for pushback from those guys that could alter Turkey's behavior? We'll do this, but only if you do that.
Actually, I would argue that pushback has been in place. And that's one of the reasons why suddenly Erdogan decided to reach out. Because ultimately, when you think about it, the more Erdogan played the role of a bully in the East Med, the more he precipitated Cyprus, Greece, Egypt, Israel, Jordan, and others coming together. And the East Med Gas Forum is the most concrete example of this, you know, joining of forces. And to add to that, we have seen, for example, if I told you 2 decades ago that, you know, by 2020, 2021, we would see military exercises where we see, you know, Israel, Cyprus, you know, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, you know, working together and US working together, that would be science fiction, right? That would be beyond one's imagination. I would argue one positive, quote unquote, paradoxically positive role Erdogan played in Middle East history has been to push such a coming together by his bullying stance, by his belligerent posturing. And in fact, it is this sense of isolation, being left out, that forced Erdogan, even half-heartedly, try to reach out to Egypt, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, hoping that this would derail some of the existing partnerships in the region. Now, my prediction is this will not happen, meaning I think regional countries are sophisticated enough to read Erdogan's game, and they will continue to deepen their ongoing economic, political, and military cooperation while also looking for opportunities to de-escalate tensions with Turkey. But they will not see this as a kind of a mutually exclusive zero-sum game.
Which is interesting because, as you and I discussed before, the Biden administration is backing off in its support of the pipeline from the Eastern Med into Europe, which could be the Biden administration's way of being nice to Turkey, hoping to encourage it to come in. But it also seems that it's undermining the efforts of the regional actors to maintain a solid front. So it seems to me that the countries of the region do need help from the transatlantic partners, from the NATO partners, even to maintain their own sense of pushback against Turkey. Do you see any of it?
Now, this is a very timely and important question. I think that there is still very much debate about the nature of the non-paper the U.S. State Department issued and what messages that non-paper is really sending. You know, it wasn't that well received in the region. Some saw it as in part being appeasing to Turkey, although in other parts it could also be offensive to Turkey as well. So some analysts argued it was an unintentional mix of environmentalist priorities with some misguided regional diplomatic priorities that ended up serving none of the kind of aimed goals. But I think it's still early to make sense of where that non-paper will evolve to. But ultimately, my response would be this. I think that the ongoing partnership in the East Med is not just a pragmatic partnership solely built around the idea of building a pipeline. Yes, there are economic incentives to working together. And in fact, you know, when this idea was first raised, you know, when I was still back in Turkish parliament and there were a lot of regional meetings, summits, some of which I also attended, including in Cyprus and Israel. And there was a lot of reference to the European coal and steel community. Some people argue that, look at the European experience, you know, that coming together around coal and steel then spilled over into the European Union project. So people were hoping that hydrocarbon cooperation in the East Med would spill over into political and diplomatic cooperation. What I can tell, you know, in less than a decade, although we don't have a pipeline in place, I already see a lot of political, diplomatic, and back then what was unthinkable, military cooperation. And so I would argue that normally I do believe that the US has a major leadership role to play. And it really makes a big difference if the US provides incentives in the right direction. But this is one case where there is a regional momentum, meaning endogenous momentum. And this partnership, this cooperation, I think will continue. So paradoxically, again, ironically, one could argue that this is one development. Washington needs to decide whether it will be a part of or whether it will be left outside of. So maybe this is one case where, yes, the US leadership would have mattered, but even if the U.S. is to provide headwinds, I think this cooperation will continue to deepen. And I would argue that it is in the best interest of the transatlantic alliance to be involved, you know, early on and in concrete ways in this, what I consider to be a positive coming together in the region.
So we're coming to the end of the program, and people who tune in more than once know that I like to end on a positive note. I think that's always the way to go. And I think you've just given us one. I just want to sort of emphasize that thinking. Yes, we always like for the United States to be in the front of good things. But it's possible that even if we're not in the front, good things will happen without us. So if you look at Turkey going into the future and the Turkish people, to the extent that they have power in their own country, and they do as long as there are elections, the Turkish people see positive influences in the region. The Turkish non-Erdogan parties, the Turkish non-Islamist parties see good things happening in the region. Is there momentum so that Turkey sees itself needing and wanting to be part of good things that happen rather than being aligned with Russia or China or Qatar or other countries that have a kind of negative pull? Is all of this going to find its way into the Turkish psyche?
Now, my answer to this, I have to begin with a caveat, is an outlier position. Because even among Erdogan critics, lately we have seen a number of very sophisticated analysis arguing and presenting, you know, good rationale why there will be more of the same for Turkey even after Erdogan. And their logic is that Turkish foreign and security policy are not just driven by Erdogan's idiosyncrasies, and a lot of it also rests on the new reconfiguration of global power struggles and Ankara's attempts to find a new role in that new world order. So they argue that, yes, there might be a change in style. Yes, Turkey might be less belligerent, rhetorically kind of more cordial, but ultimately, they argue, don't expect many U-turns. Now, I would disagree respectfully, because I think what people are missing is this. Over the course of the Turkish Republic's 100-year history, so by 2023, it will be the centennial of the Turkish Republic, we have seen a Turkey that has taken significant new directions. For example, Turkey's turn to NATO and the Western Alliance in the aftermath of the Second World War was such a groundbreaking event that changed Turkey radically, and so on and so forth. So Turkey has a history of, or for example, Turkey's turn to the European Union membership process and taking significant reform steps to fulfill the Copenhagen criteria. So this shows that Turkey actually is capable of taking new courses in its foreign and security policy. That's my first reasoning. Second, never underestimate the frustration and the resentment and the anger in the average Turkish citizen toward Turkey's ruling bloc. And it is really a unique opportunity that we have all the usual suspects in power today. Islamists, far-right ultranationalists, Eurasianists, far-right xenophobes and racists, you know, anti-Kurdish, supremacists. Now, this gives the rest of the Turkish society an opportunity to, in a wholesale fashion, reject all these radicalisms, extremisms, and supremacisms. And why this matters is that if and when the Turkish electorate want to go in the exact opposite direction of this disaster course, they will need to turn to, you know, a free market economy, a rules-based economy, a Western alliance, cordial relations with regional powers, and really pulling 180 turn on engagement with radical Islam in the region. So I would argue that don't be surprised if only within a few years of the change of hand of power in Turkey, you see not only a return to Turkey's traditional foreign and security policy, but an improved and more robust version that is even more dedicated to liberal democracy, to transatlantic values and also to regional cooperation.
I consider that a terrific, optimistic ending to our program. I think there is a lot to look forward to. Turkey has been for many years a good friend to many countries and can be that again. And we're going to hold you to your optimistic positions and invite you back in the future to see how it works out. Aykan Erdemir, thank you for an enlightening and very, very important look at a very important country. To everybody else, we'll be back next week. Thank you.
Thank you, Shoshana.